The Attorney General wishes to announce that the following program has been rated
liberal rubbish
by the Department of Justice.
All right, guard, begin the unnecessarily slow-moving dipping mechanism.
What in the wide, wide world of sports is going on here?
Isn't he simply adorable, Pop?
I told you never trust a monkey!
Listen, you smell something.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourselves down!
Welcome back to the Cup of Joe Radio Show. I'm your host, Joe Vecchio. Hope you're all doing pretty well out there. I was a little delayed doing it this week, doing the show this week, because I got hit with a very nasty stomach virus yesterday and spent pretty much all day in bed just running back and forth to the bathroom and being too weak to do pretty much anything except for a very quick update on the site before the sickness really hit. The baseball season's over as far as I'm concerned. The two teams that I had wanted to get into the series died a big, horrible death, and we're stuck with the Yankees and the Marlins, which is something I don't think anybody really wanted. So as far as I'm concerned, this season is over. Nobody wins. No matter who wins, nobody wins, because I can't stand the Marlins, and I can stand the Yankees even less. So I felt so bad for that poor kid, and everybody knows what I'm talking about, the kid who interfered with the play. And my question is, shouldn't the umpires have called the batter out immediately? I mean, someone brought up the fact to me that it's not fan interference if it's done by the home team fan. I don't know if that's true or not, but I always thought that the rule was if the fan reaches out into the field and the ball is in the field, so long as it's not literally in the stands, then if a fan interferes with it, then the batter should be called out for fan interference. But if the guy has to reach into the stands for the ball, then it can't be fan interference because he was reaching into the stands. So either I misread a portion of the rules, or maybe it doesn't apply to the home team. I don't know, but I feel really bad for that kid. If it was Philadelphia, he would have been just shot in the stadium and thrown onto the stands. And I can't think of a more horrible, horrible way for the Cubs season to have ended. And, in fact, for the Cubs and Red Sox, their season really ended in the same way, that their ace pitcher was left in for too long. I was watching Game 7, and Kerry Wood was obviously tired when it was getting down near the end, and that's what gave the Marlins leeway. And they just didn't want to bring him, so they should have brought in Farnsworth or some other guy when he was up around the 100 or so pitches. You know, I heard Andy Rooney bitching and moaning about, you know, how pitchers only throw, you know, blah, 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 and they get paid a lot of money. I said, listen, you know, throwing a ball that fast, that often, is very difficult. And with that kind of accuracy, not everybody can do that. If everybody could do it, then they wouldn't be paying these guys millions of dollars a year to do it. But They started this thing several years back, probably at least 10 years ago. I don't remember exactly when they started it, but they started really counting pitches. And when a pitcher gets over 100 pitches, they tend to pull them because they notice that there's a marked drop-off in the speed. And I think that there was certainly the case with Kerry Wood. He was obviously not the master of stuff, and he started to lose control, and admittedly he has control problems to begin with. I mean, he was, what, number two in walks to the Braves, Russ Ortiz, over 100 walks through a year. And that's a lot of walks. And But he couldn't get out of it. Usually a pitcher as good as Kerry Wood can get out of it, and this time he just couldn't. But it was obvious. I was looking at him. He was obviously breathing heavy. And it was the same thing happening with Pedro Martinez. It gets around the seventh and eighth inning. And I was thinking, oh, wonderful. It's the same time and place. And I thought the Sox were probably going to win it. By the way, the New York Post apparently thought the Sox had won. The game went late, of course, so the newspapers got delayed on it. But apparently, according to Atrios, who linked onto another site, who showed a thing in the New York Post about how the Red Sox won and they're going on to the World Series and good luck to them. And it's like, wait a minute, what time did this edition come out? They were obviously jumping the gun there a little bit. But I'm not going to say congratulations to the Yankees or Marlins because I don't like either team, frankly. And I'm not going to do it. Cubs fans, oh, I cannot tell you the agony they must be feeling. I mean, it is just horrible. I mean, I was upset that they beat my Braves, but the Braves are used to that sort of thing from now. And the Braves, you know, we've only gone through it for the last, 12 years or so? The Cubs have been going through it for much longer than that, and they've almost never had a winning team. Although what's surprising is that the Cubs are not the losingest team in baseball history. That sad distinction belongs to the Philadelphia Phillies. But losing that game in that fashion must have been sheer agony. But you don't have to listen to me to talk about what it's like to be a Cub fan. Let's let Mr. Steve Goodman tell you.
By the shores of old Lake Michigan, where the hawk wind blows so cold, an old Cub fan lay dying. In his midnight hour, the toll. Round his bed, his friends had all gathered. They knew his time was short. On his head they put this bright blue cap from his all-time favorite sport. Told him it's late, it's getting dark in here, and I know it's time to go. But before I leave the lineup, boys, there's just one thing that I'd like to know. Do they still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls around? When the snow melts away, do the Cubbies still play in their ivy-covered burial ground? When I was a boy, they were my pride and joy, but now they only bring fatigue to the home of the brave, the land of the free, the doormat of the National League. He told his friends, you know the law of averages says anything will happen that can. That's what it says. But the last time the Cubs won a National League pennant was the year we dropped the bomb on Japan. The Cubs made me a criminal, sent me down a wayward path. They stole my youth from me. That's the truth. I'd forsake my teachers to go sit in the bleachers in flagrant truancy. And then one thing led to another, and soon I discovered alcohol, gambling, dope, football, hockey, lacrosse, tennis. But what do you expect when you raise up a young boy's hopes and then just crush them like so many paper beer cups? Year after year after year, after year after year after year after year after year. Till those hopes are just so much popcorn for the pigeons beneath the L tracks to eat. He said, you know, I'll never see Wrigley Field anymore before my eternal rest. So if you have your pencils and your scorecards ready, I'll read you my last request. He said, give me a doubleheader funeral in Wrigley Field on some sunny weekend day, no lights. Have the organ play the national anthem, and then a little na-na-na-na, hey, 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 goodbye. Make six bullpen pitchers carry my coffin, and six groundskeepers clear my path. Have the umpires bark me out at every base in all their holy wrath. It's a beautiful day for a funeral. Hey, Ernie, let's play too. Somebody go get Jack Brickhouse to come back and conduct just one more interview. Have the Cubbies run right out into the middle of the field. Have Keith Moreland drop a routine fly. Give everybody two bags of peanuts and a frosty malt, and I'll be ready to die. Build a big fire on home plate out of your Louisville Slugger baseball bats and toss my coffin in. Let my ashes blow in a beautiful snow from the prevailing 30-mile-an-hour southwest wind. When my last remains go flying over the left field wall, we'll bid the bleacher bums adieu. And I will come to my final resting place out on Waveland Avenue. The Dying Man's friends told him to cut it out. They said, stop it, that's an awful shame. He whispered, don't cry, we'll meet by and by near the Heavenly Hall of Fame. He said, I've got season's tickets to watch the Angels now. So that's just what I'm gonna do. He said, but you, the living, you're stuck here with the Cubs. So it's me that feels sorry for you. And he said, oh, play that Lonesome Losers tune. That's the one I like the best. Closed his eyes and slipped away. Well, Scotty, it was the Dying Cub fans' last request. So here it is. Do they still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls around? Do the Cubbies still play in their Ivy Cup to bear your ground? When I was a boy, they were my pride and joy, but now they only bring fatigue to the home of the brave, the land of the free and the doormat of the National
Majeski, Johnny G, Eddie Juiced, Johnny Pesky, Thornton Lee, Danny Gardella, Van Lingle, Mungo, Whitey Karowski, Max Lanier, Eddie Waitkus, and Johnny Vandermeer. Bob Estalella, Van Lingle Mungo, Augie Bergamo, Sigmund Jacuki, Big Johnny Mize, and Barney McCoskey, Hal Trosky, Augie Gullan, and Pinky May, Frenchie Bordagaray, Phil Cavaretta, George McQuinn, Howard Pollett, and Early Wynn, Roy Campanella, Van Lingle Mungo. Augie Bergamo, Sigmund Jacuki, Big Johnny Mize, and Barney McCoskey, Hal Trosky, John Antonelli, Ferris Fane, Frankie Crosetti, Johnny Sane, Harry Brookine, and Lou Boudreaux, Frankie Gustine and Claude Passo, Eddie Basinski, Ernie Lombardi, Huey Mulcahy, Van Lingle, Van Lingomungo.
Can you give us just a few basic comments about your feelings on the game?
Well, naturally, I feel bad about losing a ball game like that. There's no way you should lose that ball game, and
that just doesn't make sense.
What's your opinion of King's performance?
What's my opinion of King's performance? What the fuck do you think is my opinion of it? I think it was fucking horseshit. Put that in. I don't fucking opinion of his performance. Jesus Christ, he beat us with three fucking home runs. What the fuck do you mean, what is my opinion of his performance? How can you ask me a question like that? What is my opinion of his performance? Jesus Christ, he hit three home runs. Jesus Christ. I'm fucking pissed off to lose a fucking game. And you ask me my opinion of his performance. Jesus Christ. I mean, that's a tough question to ask me, isn't it? What is my opinion of his performance?
Yes, it is. I asked it, and you gave me an answer.
Well, I didn't give you a good answer because I'm mad, but I mean...
That wasn't a good question.
That's a tough question to ask me right now. What is my opinion of his performance? I mean, you want me to tell you what my opinion of his performance is?
It just did.
That's right. Jesus Christ. Guy hits three home runs against us. Shit. I mean, I don't mean to get pissed off or anything like that, but, you know, you asked me my opinion. I mean, he put on a hell of a show. He hit three home runs. He drove in what, seven runs?
Eight
runs. Well, what the hell more can you say about it? I didn't mean to get mad or anything like that, but goddamn, he asked me my opinion of his performance. See you, Joe. Shit.
From the sublime to the obscene, who says baseball's a boring game? That was Tommy Lasorda talking about Dave Kingman. For those of you who are baseball fans like me, Kingman was a slugger who played for a lot of different teams, including the Mets, the Giants, and the Cubs. He was known for either hitting a home run or striking out. That was his basic deal. He hit over 500 homers in his career, but you won't see him in the Hall of Fame. Before that was Dave Frischberg with Van Lingomungo, which is nothing but names of baseball players. He was a jazz artist who came across the name Van Lingomungo while looking through a baseball book, and he thought it was such a cool name, and he just took other cool names. Some of those guys that he mentioned in there, Johnny Sane, Johnny Vandermeer, Roy Campanella, they're Hall of Famers. Johnny Vandermeer is known mostly for being the only pitcher in baseball to throw two consecutive no-hitters, a remarkable feat in and of itself. And, of course, before that we had Steve Goodman, a dying Cub fan's last request, which is, in my opinion, the best baseball song of the many baseball songs there are. That's the best ever written and ever performed. It really epitomizes what baseball is about, and what baseball is about is losing. I mean, people think of the Yankees, you know, and all that stuff, but, you know, teams like the Cubs, teams like the Red Sox, they have just as much mystique and history and popularity as the winning teams. You can't say that about any other sport. And baseball, more than any other sport, lends itself to music. Football, what's a good football song? Can anybody tell me a decent football song? There are none. Dropkick Me Jesus Through the Goalposts of Life. If anybody can come up with a decent football song, email me. Let me know. JOEVEC@bellsouth.net. Just let me know, and I'll play it if I can find it. I want to thank Kaza again for helping me get some of this stuff. You can't beat Kaza. I mean, I understand the record industry's bitches about, you know, this and that and blah, 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 but you know what? It's the best way to get songs that you just can't get anywhere else. They're either not available or they're simply not sold in stores, or just somebody just has it on their computer. The Tommy Lasorda one, that's you can actually get that, but it's bleeped. It's on the Baseball's Greatest Hits CD. But it's bleeped, so I don't know where that person found the unexpurgated version of that, but I'm glad it is because it sounds much better. Tommy Lasorda, for those of you who don't know who he is, was the manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers. You know, the Dodgers from like 1960 through like 1990 almost had basically two managers. They had Walter Olson and had Tommy Lasorda, and that was it. And since Rupert Murdoch took over, they've had three or four managers, so it just goes to show what difference it makes when you have different ownership. This is Joe Vecchio again. This is the Cup of Joe Radio Show. This is episode number 4, by the way. And I've been talking about baseball because the season, as I mentioned before, is over for me as far as I'm concerned. I have absolutely no more interest in watching any of the games. As far as I'm concerned, they might as well not exist. Obviously, Yankees fans and Marlins fans, you know, are happy, and they're going to be watching the series. Me, I'm avoiding it like the plague. If either the Red Sox or the Cubs did not get in, I had no interest in watching it, because either way, if either one of those teams would have won, it would have been history. I happen to love baseball. I grew up with baseball, and I grew up in Brooklyn, where baseball is practically a religion. And so I have a lot of very fond feelings for the game. I think it's the best sport of all of the sports, because unlike all the other sports, the whole premise is different. I mean, every other major team sport is really a variation on the same theme. You have two groups of people who try to do something with an object more often than the other team in a set span of time. Football, you move a football and you try to cross the goal lines. In soccer, you try to put it in the net. Or lacrosse, you try to put it in the net. In hockey, you try to put it in the net. Basketball, you try to put it in a basket. You know, it's all basically the same type of deal, just variations on the same thing. Baseball is completely and totally different. When you're on offense in baseball, the defense controls the ball. Baseball is the only sport where if something occurs off of the official area, that is in what they call foul territory, it can still count in the game. In other words, if a guy catches a pop-up in foul territory, the batter's out, period. Or in a situation like that, even if the guy goes up into the stands and manages to grab the ball, then the guy's still out. So that's the difference. I mean, in football, you throw the ball out of bounds and you catch it out of bounds, that's it. Or if a player even runs out of bounds during the course of running a route, like a receiver, if he runs out of bounds, you know, then he can't come back in and make a catch. And that's against the rules. So, baseball is also the only sport where if someone comes out of the game, they're out of the game for good. They don't come back. In football, they change players back and forth to go on offense and defense, and that's understandable. In basketball, there are certain rules and regulations about when and how you change players out, but you can go out of the game and then come back in later. Hockey, what I like about hockey, and hockey is actually my second favorite sport overall, what I like about hockey is that players change on the fly. It's the only sport of all the time sports that does this, where the clock doesn't stop or there's action still going on as the players are changing. So theoretically, it's possible to go through a 60-minute game in 60 minutes, because if you assume nobody scores a goal and there's no penalties, you can just keep going and keep playing, although I imagine everybody would get tired after that. But baseball will always have a special place in my heart for me, because it's such a wonderful sport and it lends itself to such great music. Okay, what else is going on? Not too long ago on CNN, there was a debate between the 9 people running for the Democratic nomination for president. So I remember all of them. Well, Howard Dean, Wesley Clark, Carol Moseley Braun, Al Sharpton, Joe Lieberman, Dick Gephardt, John Kerry, Dennis Kucinich, and John Edwards. I believe that's all of them. Really, excuse me. Really, the two people who are leading the pack would be Howard Dean and Wesley Clark. Wesley Clark being the general of NATO, who led our troops to victory in Bosnia. Howard Dean being the former governor of Vermont. If you look at fundraising, Governor Dean has them all beat because he's raised a lot of money, a lot more than any of the other candidates, and continues to because of his use of the internet and stuff like that. A disclaimer, I will give this again, I am a volunteer for the Dean campaign, although I am hardly what you call a major player in it. I do go out and help out, and I really do it more because I want to learn more about the political scene than I do because I am an avid supporter of Governor Dean, which I am at this point in time. I will, of course, vote for any of the nominees, any of them who win the nomination, basically, because I am so anti-George Bush and anti-everything he and his administration stands for. This is definitely a case of a lesser of whatever evils. I wish there was a Franklin Roosevelt somewhere out there. but there is not, so we take what we get. And Governor Dean, I think, is a pretty good choice, but we'll see what happens. Some of them, I think, should just drop out completely. As much as I like her personally, Kara Mosley Braun has no business being in a selection at this point. She is probably on the lowest rung of fundraising, which is a powerful indication of the type of support she gets. And while she is outspoken, you know, well-spoken, very intelligent, I really don't think she has any chance at all of winning. Although she might be a good part of, she would be a good part of any administration. I mean, she was an ambassador to the United Nations, very well-read, very intelligent, someone you would want to have in your organization somewhere. But that's really not what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about how the candidates were treated by CNN, in particular by Judy Woodruff, who was the quote-unquote moderator of this debate, and how she treated these candidates. And she was very openly disrespectful in the sense that she constantly interrupted them. In a couple of cases, if she didn't like the answer, she kind of turned her back and, you know, that sort of thing. And it's like, she would not do that with George W. Bush. And the reason she wouldn't do that for George W. Bush is because her bosses are all Bush supporters. And she knows that if she did that to him, then she would be out of a job because the press would be on her case in a minute. But it's all right for her to turn her back on war hero John Kerry or on Governor Dean or any of the candidates, you know, any of them, really. Even Al Sharpton, who doesn't have the best reputation in the world, you shouldn't just, you know, dislike that. And it's really disgusting to me to see the national media, specifically the television media, treat people like that. And unfortunately, we just come to expect it from them because they're scum at this point. That's the way I feel. And as far as I'm concerned, they're co-conspirators in what's been going on in this administration. These guys have gotten away with things that Bill Clinton couldn't even get close to. I mean, Clinton was impeached, and the press was happy about it for supposedly lying under oath about a blowjob. I mean, come on, people. Let's get real. If that reached to the level of impeachment, certainly lying about the war in Iraq and outing a CIA agent because her husband had the nerve to write an article saying that the policy in Iraq was wrong, in fact, that the administration was lying about it, that's just plain criminal. That's plain criminal. And it's an affront to, even if it wasn't a criminal offense, it's an affront to every moral sense that anybody ever has. These are the ones that say the grown-ups are in charge. I mean, that's just childish. That's nothing but childish at all, is all it is. And yet they get away with it. The national media is hardly paying attention to the story anymore because you had the whole thing with California. And, you know, if it had been Cubs Red Sox in the World Series, you wouldn't see an end to that. And it's just the type of thing that's going on in the media today, and it just sickens me. Look at the different coverage between the anti-war protests where millions upon millions of people, not just in this country but all over the world, gathered together and voiced their opposition to the war. In fact, in many cases, the crowds were bigger than the Vietnam War protests were during the Vietnam War. There was a lot of people who were saying, listen, this is not right. You know, you're not doing this in our name. And that was the name of the main organization, not in our name. And certainly, I feel bad for the people of Iraq, and I wish if any of them listening to me said, listen, it wasn't me. If it was up to me, we would have found a better solution for it, something that would have rid you of Hussein and given you a real chance on life instead of just another occupation. but that got hardly any coverage at all. They made a brief mention of it. Now look at if you turn that around and you look at the debate they had in Alabama over that stupid Ten Commandments thing, they got a lot more coverage of that. And that was maybe 100 or so protesters who were essentially idiots. You know, telling, you know, to people who are removing the thing that they're God-haters, get real. Isn't one of the Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not worship graven images? Wasn't that a graven image? So it really sickens me that sort of thing gets more coverage than legitimate protests and that the media covers things with such an obvious double standard. I mean, part of it is just, you know, the defeating frenzy and, you know, as Jon Stewart said on the Journey Emmys, they've just become ratings whores. The other part of it is that they do have an agenda to push, especially Fox, which is really, pardon me, especially Fox, which really is nothing more than Republican propaganda. I mean, that's all it is. And it's no longer a matter of conservative versus liberal. It's just Republicanism. It's propaganda. It's fascism is what it is. And we've said it before, and I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Just because we're not actively gassing Jews doesn't mean we aren't turning into a fascist country. We are. It's corporatism. We are run by corporate America. And those of us who are on the internet, the webloggers and the guys like me doing these little radio shows, we are the only real voice of opposition out there. And a few independent newspapers. There's very little voice that's going against what the corporate media wants. Because the corporate media is all about the same thing the corporations are about in any instance. It's all about money and power. And that's all they're interested in. That is life to them. You get more stuff, you get more power. And you get more power and you get more stuff. That's the entire life. There's nothing about just plainly enjoying your life. It's a constant competition. And you're seeing that in the media now because, you know, Fox is just doing what it does, and CNN is, because they know they're losing the ratings war, is trying desperately to be like them. But the truth of the matter is, it's a corporate media that's really run by the same small group of people. And one of the reasons why Judy Woodruff, who was the moderator, like I said, of that, gets away with what she gets away with is because she knows that if she doesn't do that, then she's out on her ass. She makes so much money. I don't know how much she makes exactly, but I bet you she makes, in if not the high six figures, the low seven figures a year for doing what she does at CNN. And if she goes against the party line, guess what happens to that gravy train? It's over. She doesn't have a job. So whether she likes it or not, she's gonna spout the party line. And that's why, you know, sites like Media Whores Online have it exactly right. They're just whores. They're doing it for the money. They have no sense of journalistic integrity. And it's all because of money. You know, a lot of people misquote the Bible thing that money is the root of all evil. That's not what the Bible says. It says love of money is the root of all evil. And I can't think of any more perfect examples of what's going on than in that sense than the Bush administration and the corporate media that is covering for him, because I think it's really sickening. And these nine presidential candidates for the Democrats are fighting such an uphill tide. And it's remarkable, even with the overwhelming amount of money that they have, the overwhelming financial advantage that they have, and in these cases they're outspending Democrats, you know, 4 or 5 to 1, they still can barely only manage a slight majority. And it goes to show how weak their message is, that they need to have that much power behind them, that much money behind them, in order to get their message across. And it's really, really sickening when that's to see that sort of thing happening. If you take the money out of it as much as possible, if you have either publicly financed campaigns or you create and enforce really, really strict laws about how to raise money and how much of it gets used in the campaigns, the Republican Party won't last one election cycle. Why? Because they have no message. The only reason they manage to get their word across is because they have tons of money for which to do it. They buy radio stations, they buy television stations, they can afford the television ads, they can afford the radio ads, they have their own people on the radio for hours upon hours upon hours every day spouting their party line. And who are they working against? Who is it hurting? It's hurting working people. It's hurting poor people who are having trouble finding work. And it's hurting basically anybody who is not a rich white male. And their whole attitude is, if you want to get rid of us, you have to become us. You know, in Lord of the Rings, they talk about the ring and how the ring is the ultimate corrupter. It has either two effects on you if you have it. If you're weak-willed, you become a slave to whoever controls the ring. Or if you're strong-willed, you become basically like the ring's creator, Sauron. You know, it's either if someone were to take it, one of the mighty were to take it, they just set themselves up eventually in their place, because that amount of power just simply corrupts. And it's really sickening. You know, and I've said this before too, we really don't care. I personally don't care about the little power games the business people play. Let them play it. Let them have their money. The same thing with the politicians. Let them play their games. Let them have their money. Let them have their fun. Do what they want. I don't care. Stop screwing with our lives. Stop making things so that unemployment goes up, and that we're not making enough money so that we can support ourselves and that we have to live our lives in fear. I'm not interested in becoming your peasant. I'm not interested in becoming your servant because I'm no good at making money, okay, or making the kinds of money that you're talking about. I'm not interested in that, and neither are a lot of other people. We just want to go on with our lives. Stop screwing with us. But they'll never understand that because money and power is the only thing they understand, and that's the only thing they're going to grab. They've got 90% of everything. They're not going to be satisfied until they get 100% of everything. And right now we have a situation where I think the top 10% of the country, the wealthiest 10% of the people in the country, own something like 70 to 80% of the entire wealth, and everybody else is just fighting for scraps. And that's outrageous. The distribution should be a lot fairer than that, because I'll tell you something, nobody earns that kind of money fairly. I don't care what anybody says, nobody earns that kind of money fairly. If you're getting that kind of dough, you're doing something wrong. You're doing something illegal, you're doing something immoral, you're screwing somebody over. And I hear people bitch about the baseball players who make $2 to $3 million a year, and some a lot more than that. And they say, well, look, you know, can you hit a 90-mile-an-hour fastball that hard? Can you do that? I mean, it's an obvious skill that you can see and that you can watch, and these people do their thing in public day in and day out. Nobody pays a damn cent to watch George Steinbrenner sign paperwork all day or talk on the telephone all day. No one pays a penny to see that. But people pay good money for it, so you can see at least why these people make these salaries. But these shadow figures, these guys like George Bush and the people who operate behind him, what they do is mostly get connections and know how to separate people from their money. And that's all they do. As I mentioned the last time, they had the movie Casino on, which is about a bunch of guys who ran a casino, which is the third in a series of Scorsese movies about the same group of people. These people in Casino, they have nothing on the crime cartel that is the Bush family and their financial supporters, because that's all they are, is a crime cartel. They're a mafia family en large. And that's how they operate. And again, I wouldn't even mind them doing that so long as they left us the hell alone. But the problem is they can't stop. They can't help themselves. And sooner or later, they're going to go too far. I mean, I kept thinking that they had already gone too far, but obviously it hasn't quite reached that point yet. When the real middle class starts to lose money and when things really start to go backwards for them, then we're going to see a real change again. I mean, as I've said also before, things were far worse 100 years ago in this country, and it took a while to build up a resistance to it and develop an organization. But finally, in 1932, Roosevelt got elected, and the New Deal got enacted. And guess what? The country prospered. You know, it took a while for some of the things to get put into place, but the country prospered, and we did well. And we could do well again if we're just allowed to. But money. Money is the whole problem. And it just corrupts everything. It ruins everything. So I mentioned that last show, too. But I was very upset when I saw that debate on CNN. I actually had to turn it off because I just couldn't stand Woodruff's attitude. You know, these people make so much money now that they have absolutely no clue as to what guys like me are going through in life because of these policies. That's why they really don't care one way or the other, because they know if they just keep spouting the party line, they can keep living the high life. I mean, they work hard, but it's not really worth it to me, doing what they're doing. But, you know, it's their soul and it's their problem. I just wish there was a way to put an end to it in the sense of forcing them to be real journalists, you know, finding a way that news is not treated as ratings. You know, we live in a media nation where we live and die by the media, where the marketing of a thing is more important than the actual thing itself. And Windows is a perfect example. Windows is a much better marketed operating system than any of the other systems, even though some of the other systems are better, like Unix and stuff like that. But that's, you know, that's all part of it. And people like Woodruff, people like the anchors on CNN, and even a lot of the regular beat reporters in newspapers, they make so much more money than the average person making, you know, $9 or $10 an hour, and that's pretty good for a lot of people. They make so much more money than they make, and they just are completely disconnected. It didn't used to be that way. It used to be beat reporters and stuff like that. The lower level guys made about the same amount of money as everybody else, so they had a basic understanding of things that were going on. Nowadays, they don't, because they make a lot more money, and they really can't put themselves in our position anymore. And we all have to suffer because of it. Anyway, it's just really, it's all a big scam. The media is working together with the administration to push this agenda, to push this war, and to shove a lot of things down our throats that we don't really want. But, you know, they got all the power right now. We're just going to have to stand here and fight back as best we can. That's what I'm doing. I realize I'm rambling on a little bit about this, but, you know, I'm just doing what I can, and the other bloggers are doing what they can, and we're all going to get together, and just hopefully we'll be a real voice for change. I think what Dr. Dean is doing with this internet campaign is going to hopefully change the face of politics, and hopefully we can get an administration in there that will change these laws so that if we're going to be operating on the same playing field, let's operate on a playing field of ideas and not on a playing field that's basically who's got more money and who doesn't. Everything is so tilted against us on the left right now. So, anyway, we got some other stuff going on. Let's listen to the refreshments, and we'll be right back.
So just how far down do you want to go? Well, we could talk it out over a cup of Joe, and you could look deep into my eyes like I was a supermodel. Uh-huh. You and me, baby, no one else we could trust. We'll say nothing to no one, no how. Or we bust and never crack a smile, or flinch or cry for nobody. So I'll keep the faces, yeah, and that seems fair. We'll be right back.
like when's at hand. But I keep living this day like the next will never come. Oh, help me, but don't tell me to deny it. I gotta cleanse myself of all these lies till I'm good enough for him.
Listen to this abortion debate, the more you hear this phrase, sanctity of life. You've heard that, sanctity of life. You believe in it? Personally, I think it's a bunch of shit. Well, I mean, life is sacred? Who said so? God? Hey, if you read history, you realize that God is one of the leading causes of death. Has been for thousands of years. Hindus, Muslims, Jews, Christians, all taking turns killing each other because God told them it was a good idea. The sword of God, the blood of the Lamb, vengeance is mine. Millions of dead motherfuckers. Millions of dead motherfuckers, all because they gave the wrong answer to the God question. You believe in God? No. Dead. You believe in God? Yes. You believe in my God? No. Dead. My God has a bigger dick than your God. Of years. Thousands of years, and all the best wars, too. The bloodiest, most brutal wars fought, all based on religious hatred. Which is fine with me, eh? Anytime a bunch of holy people want to kill each other, I'm a happy guy. But don't be giving me all this shit about the sanctity of life. I mean, even if there were such a thing, I don't think it's something you can blame on God. Now, you know where the sanctity of life came from? We made it up. You know why? Because we're alive. Self-interest. Living people have a strong interest in promoting the idea that somehow life is sacred. You don't see Abbott and Costello running around talking about this shit, do you? We're not hearing a whole lot from Mussolini on the subject. What's the latest from JFK? Not a goddamn thing. Because JFK, Mussolini, and Abbott and Costello are fucking dead. They're fucking dead. And dead people give less than a shit about the sanctity of life. Only living people care about it, so the whole thing grows out of a completely biased point of view. It's a self-serving, man-made bullshit story. It's one of these things we tell ourselves so we'll feel noble. Life is sacred. Makes you feel noble. Well, let me ask you this. If everything that ever lived is dead, and everything alive is going to die, where does the sacred part come in? I'm having trouble with that. Because, I mean, even with the stuff we preach about the sanctity of life, we don't practice it. We don't practice it. Look at what we kill. Mosquitoes and flies, because they're pests. Lions and tigers, because it's fun. Chickens and pigs, because we're hungry. Pheasants and quails, because it's fun. And we're hungry. And people, we kill people. Because they're pests. And it's fun. And you might have noticed something else. The sanctity of life doesn't seem to apply to cancer cells, does it? You rarely see a bumper sticker that says, save the tumors. Or I break for advanced melanoma. Ah, viruses, mold, mildew, maggots, fungus, weeds, E. coli bacteria, the crabs. Nothing sacred about those things. So at best, the sanctity of life is kind of a selective thing. We get to choose which forms of life we feel are sacred, and we get to kill the rest. Pretty neat deal, huh? You know how we got it? We made the whole fucking thing up! Made it up! The same way... Thank you.
George Carlin, The Sanctity of Life. It's remarkable how comedians always seem to find a very straightforward way of dealing with serious issues and doing it in a humorous way, as opposed to someone like me who talks about it in a very boring way. I was reading an article in the Houston Chronicle about four white men who had beat a mentally retarded disabled black man almost to death. And while I was reading that article, in the same issue of the newspaper online, I saw an article about a Texas couple suing a hospital for the wrongful death of their as-yet-unborn son. Now, the former story really isn't about anything more than just a bunch of drunken jerks who took a lot of pleasure in torturing a helpless person just because he was helpless. I mean, whether or not he was black, that may or may not have had something to do with it, but it just made him an easy target because he was a helpless person. The FBI was trying to determine at the time whether the crime was racially motivated. Well, we'll have to see where that comes. Now, the other story, which was about a Texas couple who was suing a hospital for the wrongful death of their as-yet-unborn child, that seems almost purely political in the sense that this is a couple that's intending to force the Texas courts to make a clear determination of when a fetus is a parasitical being living inside a womb and when it is a full human being deserving of all the rights we have. A law considers it to be a double murder. I don't know if that's a Texas law or if it's federal law, if someone murders a pregnant woman, and that, of course, is one of the basis of the couple's argument. Now, the four white men have rightly been imprisoned, but charged only with aggravated assault, which is a second-degree felony. But in my opinion, it was their intent to kill him. They really wanted him to kill him. I mean, they left him in a ditch on the side of a road. Okay? There aren't that many details about it in the articles. Just one of the accused claims to have found him in the ditch 3 hours after he was dumped there. Maybe he was trying to clear himself from charges by being the one who nobly rescued him. Maybe he had a guilty conscience. I don't know. But it seems clear to me that after they had their fun, the man was left to die. Now, speaking to me personally, it seems that the beating of an adult male practically to death and with the intent of killing him warrants more punishment than the loss of a fetus, especially since there was some question as to the prenatal care that the woman was giving her unborn child. Now, apparently she gained 50 pounds during the course of her pregnancy. And I talked to my wife about that. Now, my wife has three children from a previous marriage, and I asked her if that was unusual for someone to gain 50 pounds, and she said, yes, it was. She gained 50 pounds during her second son birth, but she added, she didn't hit that weight until her son was almost born. This woman was 7.5 months into the pregnancy, still a month and a half left. And Kathy, my wife, was underweight to begin with. She only weighed about 105 pounds before the pregnancy. This woman in the article, she weighed about 250 pounds, and according to Kathy, to have gained 50 pounds in only 7.5 months is excessive. Now, my wife and I occasionally fight over the issue of aborting. She's adamantly against it for very personal reasons. She herself was almost aborted, and of course she uses that against me at every opportunity. My arguments are much more pragmatic. It seems to me if you can sue a hospital for wrongful death in this case, then it would be almost possible to charge a couple for murder, since after all, the fetus was living inside the mother. If you believe, like some people do, that a fetus is a living human being from the moment of conception, then you have to treat every miscarriage as a possible murder case and investigate it as such. The idea of a woman forcing a miscarriage isn't that common, uncommon, after all. Don't we have a trial? And should anyone who knows about it and doesn't do anything to stop it or even helps be considered as an accessory to murder? These are not just cut-and-dry issues. These are very difficult, complex issues, regardless of what fundamentalists want you to believe. And I wonder, you know, if the four guys who were accused of beating up this black guy, if they have wives or girlfriends, and how they would feel about them having an abortion or being placed on trial because they miscarried. Would they feel the same joy that they felt when they were beating up this helpless man? Or is it okay to do that because the guy was a stranger and, of course, black? Some of the same people who are against abortion, in all cases, are the biggest cheerleaders for our campaign against Iraq, despite the questionable evidence of its motives or its necessity. And make no mistake, our bombs did kill pregnant women and children. I mean, these kind of deaths seem acceptable if you're talking about higher issues, such as giving Iraqis the benefits of American culture and, of course, converting them. From a political point of view, it's religion that's the driving force behind the anti-abortion life is sacred movement. Look, it's obvious that some life is more sacred than other life. Let me read to you something that my friend Bruce the Psychic Guy, or Bruce, otherwise known as Beachon, on his live journal, he was talking about the death of Mrs. Terry Schiavo. Now, this is the euthanasia part of the argument. This is the other end of the spectrum. She was 39-year-old Florida woman who was in an accident in 1990 and has been living basically in a vegetative state since then. According to what Bruce wrote, she can breathe, maintain a heartbeat and blood pressure on her own. She can see, has a limited ability to move her limbs, but cannot chew or swallow and required a food and water tube to sustain her life. Her husband wanted to end it, and her parents wanted to keep her alive. But the husband retained the court order to have the food tube removed and basically end her life. Bruce went on to say, the Nazis had a term for the people they killed, life unworthy unlife. Together, Mr. Schiavo and two judges have decided that Mrs. Schiavo was unworthy of life. And history teaches us what happens when a government arrogates itself to itself the power to decide which human beings have the right to live and which do not. The very foundation of Western civilization, the sanctity of human life, disappears. In other words, abortion and euthanasia today, gas chambers tomorrow. The slippery slope that appeared in 1973 is growing ever more steep. Today they're killing Terry Schiavo. Tomorrow it might be me, your loved ones, or you. May God forgive us. I think Bruce is being a little melodramatic there. Of course, he sees things as being on a slippery slope. What you have to understand is that Bruce is a monarchist. And he calls himself a true conservative in the sense of pre-1793 Europe, before the French Revolution. And he believes in the divine right of kings. Of course, anybody who knows anything about history knows that kings got to be kings in more than a few circumstances by killing the previous king. So I guess so much for the sanctity of life there. And it's obvious that some life is more sacred than other life. I mean, obviously, a Christian life like Mrs. Schiavo is more important than the life of an Iraqi kid who we're bombing in order to save them from themselves or whatever. We have to kill them in order to save them. You know, it's obvious that we have a double standard and that we have we allow ourselves different standards for different lives. I mean, we cheer the people who die when we're told that they're enemies, regardless of how falsely they've been accused. We mourn the deaths of those we identify with, regardless of how brutally or illegally they act. We mourn for fetuses, yet casually turn our backs to the deaths caused by poverty and hopelessness, even to the point of continuing the policies that cause poverty, as if they were two separate things, two different classes of people who get different treatment. Look, the human race is still in the process of becoming. That is, we're still learning and growing, and hopefully one day we'll overcome that darker side of our natures, the side that makes us want to attack helpless people for the emotional rush it gives us, the side that lives in paranoid fear of an unknowable, all-powerful God, and the side that ruthlessly kills others for no other reason than greed and lust for power. I don't think we're going to achieve this in our lifetimes, but I hope that we can survive as a race long enough to make it possible. You know, Bruce, I understand, you know, believes in life, but, you know, there are extremes. Yes, you know, you can make the point where, you know, if we start on A, then eventually it's going to be, it's kind of like saying, well, if you start on drinking, you eventually go to pot. If you start on pot, you eventually go to harder drugs, blah, blah, blah. And that's not necessarily so. I mean, I know Bruce drinks, but he doesn't do pot. And I know people who do pot but don't do any harder drugs. And I think there is some room for leeway in this. I mean, maybe there would have been an easier case for the husband to just abrogate all responsibility for Mrs. Schiavo and say, all right, you think she's worthy of living, you know, to her parents, you take over. You know, you have to think of the frightful expense, too, of keeping her alive day in and day out like that. I mean, that doesn't, you know, that's not cheap. And it's quite possible that Mr. Schiavo was suffering severe financial stress. Would his wife have wanted that, for him to go through that? And how much aware was she? How much was she really a human being? We don't really know for sure. The doctors say one thing, her parents say another thing. I'm sure Bruce, being a Christian, will believe that her soul was still there. And, you know, do we just leave it all in God's hands all the time? I mean, if something happens, do we just say, oh, it's God's will? If a doctor screws up and someone dies, is that just God's will? You know, I mean, Frank Burns used to say that. He was a rotten surgeon. When something went wrong, when it was always just God's will. You know, and it's like, wait a minute, that's, you know. And there are people who refuse to go to doctors because they figure if something happens to them, the only thing that'll save them is prayer. I mean, is that the way we want to live? Just get rid of all the doctors because that's somehow going against what God will? I mean, if God has the right to determine when someone's going to live, he has the right to determine when someone's going to die, too. Do doctors have the right to go against the will of God by saving someone's life if they were going to die without their help? Of course, Bruce is saying, well, you know, this is the opposite case. Well, he's saying they're killed. Well, you know, what is life in that sense? Is she a sentient human being anymore? You know, Bruce doesn't care about non-sentient life, obviously. I mean, he doesn't talk about the sanctity of life. He talks about the sanctity of human life. But is it really a human life? Was Mrs. Schiavo really a human life? Is a human fetus really a human life? If you want to take it to extremes, the far end of the abortion extreme is, you can go before conception. You can assume that every time a woman has her period, that she's guilty of murder, because all a period is the removal of an unfertilized egg. An egg goes into the fallopian tubes, wherever it goes, and stays there until it gets fertilized. And if it doesn't get fertilized, the body washes it out and puts a new egg. And women do not use every single one of their eggs. Isn't every one of those eggs a potential life? And is in every sperm a potential life? Every time a guy jacks off, he's killing billions upon billions, well, millions upon millions of potential lives. Now, of course, you cannot simply have every single one of those become a life. I mean, even if you wanted to go to a point where you're removing eggs from a human body and fertilizing them outside of the womb, how many more, you know, we've already got a population explosion in this world. I mean, pragmatically and realistically, you know, you can only support X amount of human beings. I mean, we haven't reached that point yet, but we're getting there. I mean, we're 6 billion people now. And that's been going up at a geographic level since, you know, for the last 100 or 200 years. That's been going up, geometric. You know, that's been going up tremendously. I mean, is that what we really want? Do we want to overcrowd the world that much? I mean, you know, I don't really know. I haven't. Bruce is not here to talk to you about that. I don't know how he feels about birth control. Is birth control against God's will because you're preventing the potential human life? I don't happen to think it is. So, these are not simple issues. These are very difficult issues and complex issues. But as I pointed out, the human race is still growing. And we're going to have to learn to deal with these issues. I don't believe that because Mrs. Schiavo is being put to death that we're looking at gas chambers. Just as I don't believe that making abortions legal is going to lead to gas chambers. And I also don't believe that people are going to go so far as to go to the extremes that I talk about. I mean, is it a punishable crime? You know, if you want to go to that extreme, you should arrest a woman for having a period. And the second your child reaches puberty, you should impregnate her immediately. And that all women should be there for is to pump out a unit every 9 months. And the second she's ready to have kids again, make her have kids. Is that the kind of world you want to live in? Because if people are going to go to extremes in one direction, they're going to want to go to extremes in another direction. There's always a comfortable middle that we have to fall into. And you have to have a certain arrogance and a certain callousness about death, because death is all around us. I mean, death happens, whether it's human life or other life. And like I keep saying, you know, we have to kill a lot of things in order to survive. A lot of people have to live poor, live miserable lives in order for a few people to live rich. I personally want to end that. I'd like everybody to have a good chance of living. I'd like to have some sort of system where we can have a reasonable population in the world so that we're not overdoing it and we're not underdoing it, because you don't want everything to overflow. But I'd like it to be based on something more pragmatic and something more realistic than just bowing to an unknowable, all-powerful God. How do we know what God thinks? I mean, it says so in the Bible, but the Bible says a lot of different things and a lot of contradictory things. And certainly, like I said, a lot of Christians, you know, believe very strongly in the war in Iraq. We have one general, apparently, who thinks the war in Iraq is just a big war against Satan. So who knows? Okay, I don't want to get too depressing. It's really important issue, and it's something that's going to be talked about long after I finish. So, but that's the show for this week. We'll see you next week, and we'll talk to you then. It's the Cup of Joe Radio Show. I'm your host, Joe Vecchio. Bye. Oh,